Welcome to Inside Groove, the only motorsports show where super modifieds are king, methanol is aromatic, and the drivers carry their balls in a bag. Inside Groove is powered by IPC Indy, creating performance parts and solutions for the automotive, aerospace, and communications industries. Here's your host and fellow superholic, Tom Baker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Inside Groove Show. My name is Tom Baker. This is episode 141, if you're keeping track. And good to be back with you for another week here on the Groove. We have a very special guest on this show today. Jeff Carson is with us, and for those of you who don't know a lot about Jeff or maybe don't know Jeff, I think you're in for a treat with this interview because Jeff is a current car owner at the Oswego Speedway, owns the number 10 that races in the SBS division. Jeff had Mike Fowler in the car last year. Jeff's son John raced in the SBS a couple of years ago, but Jeff's history as a car owner goes back a number of years here. He had Russ Wood driven. Well, I guess there were several drivers who drove it, but he bought the independent front suspension Graves car that Ed Shea had, the 27 car, kept the number, and he had a bunch of different drivers in it over the course of his time. And we're going to let Jeff talk about all that, but one of a number of features as a car owner and really had some great runs and enjoyed his time there. But the Carson family's involvement directly and indirectly with the Oswego Speedway goes back decades, goes back to even farther back, I think, than my involvement with it from 73 forward, but certainly back to at least the 70s. And so it's a great story, and Jeff's a great guy, good friend, and just really enjoyed the interview that we did. So looking forward to that. That will be our next segment, and we'll have some further discussion on some things in our last segment. But I want to start the show with some bad news. Gary Albritton, who is, in my mind, one of the most talented supermodified drivers ever in terms of being able to jump in a car and get more out of the car than the car had, get the most out of a race car very quickly. Gary's had a stroke, and I heard about this actually yesterday and then saw it on the saw it confirmed this morning by Oswego Speedway on the Facebook. So Gary's had a stroke. He is recovering. He's paralyzed on one side. I don't have a lot of detail, but Gary needs our prayers and our thoughts, and he needs our good cheer. And so Gary's family has asked that fans, friends, fans, anyone involved in Oswego Speedway and, the supermodified fraternity would send cards and wishes of good cheer and all of that to Gary. And this is a time when somebody who has given so much over the years to Oswego Speedway certainly needs our help. And so I'm not going to read the address on the show here because obviously you're hearing it, you're not seeing it, but I will put the address to send it to in the post for the show. So look for that on the Inside Groove Facebook page when this show comes out here later today. So we wish Gary well, and we're praying for clarity and discernment for his care team, and certainly praying for Gary to have a speedy recovery from this and be back on his feet as soon as possible. So the other idea that I had, and I think we'll go ahead and do it, is we're going to go ahead and reshare the episode that Gary did of Inside Groove from way back in 2019. It's hard to believe that I've been doing this since 2019, but which is, you know, really, when I think about it, it's going into our 1, 2, 3, 4, like 4 years already. Crazy. We'll put that out over the weekend as well. So we'll do a double dose of the groove. We'll do the this episode will come out on Friday night, and then we'll maybe on Sunday we'll kind of give it a day, space it out, and then maybe on Sunday we'll go ahead and just reshare the interview with Gary Albritton from his original show that he did with me. It was episode like 28 or 29 or something when Gary was on. He was one of our earliest guests, and had a great time talking with him. So we'll replay that as well. So a lot to get to here, but I don't want to belabor this opening segment too long, because I want to get you right to Jeff Carson and let you hear from him, and we'll come back after that and chat about some things to wind it up here for Inside Groove 141. We'll kick off the interview with Jeff Carson right after this. Experience the age-old Irish hospitality at LaGroff's Pub & Grill, Oswego's premier local spot to grab a cold one and cheer on your favorite sports teams. Stop in for an ice-cold beer alongside some exceptional pub fare. Burgers, wings, chicken sandwiches, Philly cheesesteaks, soups, and more. You want it, they've got it, served up with more than 40 years of awesome customer service. Have a friendly game of darts against players from across the world. That's right, players from across the world. Where else in Oswego can you go to play darts against somebody from across the world? That's crazy. Watch the games on their 8 big screen TVs, or just relax at Oswego's neighborhood bar and grill, LaGroff's Pub, 187 East 10th Street in Oswego. Check them out on LaGroff's.com. Welcome back to The Groove, and this is a conversation that I know I'm not alone in saying I've been waiting for a long time, and it's finally here. Happy to have Jeff Carson as a special guest on The Groove Show. Jeff and I go back many years, had the privilege of working for Jeff at his car dealership a while back, but we knew each other before then, family, friendship between our two families, all of that, so lots of history there. But we're not here to talk about that so much as we are here to celebrate the Carson family's history with regard to Oswego Speedway and all forms of super modified racing. Jeff, welcome to the show. I want to start with, when did you start going to the races? What is your earliest memory of Oswego Speedway and racing? You know, do you remember the year approximately, and what was going on at the time?
I want to say it was 1970. Okay. My dad, of course, loved the Oswego Speedway and loved Nolan Swift, and took us kids to the races every week. We never missed a week. Wow. Since I've been 6 years old and on.
Now, you obviously have several siblings. Did all of your siblings, did you all go, or just were there just a few of you that kind of got into the racing part?
Just the boys. There was you know, four of us.
Okay.
Six total, and it was just the boys went every week.
Okay. So you obviously were a Swift fan. What do you remember about your first year of racing? I mean, I think back to when I started going in 73 at 5, and you think, you know, you think about the smell and the sight and the sound and the colors and all of that. It, what do you remember about your, you know, first experiences there?
It was basically, believe it or not, was the rivalry of different drivers. You know, my dad was a Swifty fan. You know, my brother Francis, Jimmy Champagne, you know, we all had our favorites. I was young. I just picked up the perfect car. I liked Ronnie Wallace just because of the color of the car. And, you know, it's just funny. We all had our own little drivers we choose to watch every week.
Yeah.
It was just fun. Really fun.
Well, and your family also owned the Carson's News, owned the newsstand. And that, you know, that will be forever a part of my earliest years because that's where we used to get the program, during the week. And, that was one of the places in town where it was distributed. Talk a little bit about your family's history with the newsstand and just, you know, what your dad did and all of that. And then of course, he ended up at some point getting involved at the Speedway in the popcorn stand.
My grandfather passed away when my dad was 10, so my father really didn't have a father. Grew up in the store and pretty much kept the store open with my Uncle Paul. And basically, you know, it was a real hangout for a lot of the kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talk about it quite a bit. You know, some of the kids that, you know, mom and dads are both working because of income or whatever, and the kids had a place to go. And, you know, some of the customers, it was tough because there's a lot of kids hanging out front. But, you know, and we talk about my dad and my Uncle Paul and how some of these kids, you know, bettered themselves and stayed out of trouble. And my dad was their dad, and, you know, my Uncle Paul was their dad and kept kids out of trouble. And, you know, it was just a fun, fun time in my life with all the kids hanging around the store and a lot of friends. And go with the racing, basically, you know, we sold the programs there. And, you know, I talked before about people would sit out front, wait for the Speedway press to show up in their station wagon with all the programs. And they'd be sitting there waiting to go through and go through all the programs to try to find which numbers would win to get a free pass to get in the Speedway every week.
Yep.
And it was fun watching everybody stand there. There's 8 to 10 people every day, every week waiting for the station wagon to show up.
That's
so
funny.
They can go through the programs. So, and if it was the next day, everybody said, oh, no sense getting the program at Carson's. They've already been picked over. You know, it's funny, but everybody wanted that winning free pass to get in the races the following week.
Well, I know I was one of them because that was really my earliest years, that was the only way both of my parents could go at the same time. So, and then when my brother started going, you know, now there's four of us trying to go. So the free pass, you know, came in really handy, and I was lucky enough to win several of them and thankful for all of them. But, yeah, I was one of the ones going through. And it's just funny to think back at 5 and 6 and 7 years old, you know, doing that sort of thing. And that's the first time I've heard about a line of people waiting to go through them. So I probably was 11th or 12th. Fortunately, there were some weeks there were a few winners left, I guess.
You're lucky. You just got lucky.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was part of the fun, though, and it was so – back in those days, you know, life was so much different, right? I mean, you could ride your bike around town, and the Joya garage was open, and they're working on their car, and other people are doing the same in their garages. I mean, it was a really, really awesome – amazing time in all of our lives as young people. But, you know, you now, when did your dad start working in the popcorn stand, and how did that come about? Do you remember?
Well, basically how it got started is Teddy Wall, he worked for Coca-Cola, and he actually had the back grandstands for the concessions. And he basically went to my dad and said, hey, you know, they're looking for somebody to open up the back grandstands with popcorn, peanuts, and whatever they want to sell. And he said, you know, it'd be a good mix. You know, I do the drinks and you do that. And
okay.
So basically, I want to say early 70s, 73, 74, 5, whatever, we started in the back grandstand and just did the back grandstands.
Oh.
And then Johnny Popcorn, he's called Johnny Popcorn, he had the front concessions until he decided he really wanted to retire and get out. And that's when Harry Caruso went to my dad and said, hey, you know, would you like to do the front also, take over the front? And it worked out good, and that's where we started.
So
for the front.
Was your dad actually in charge of the popcorn stand on both sides then, or was he just...
No, he owned it. He definitely
okay.
ran it.
And okay.
It was funny because I can talk about it was basically a week-by-week deal, but he had to pay. So if the races didn't go on, he had to pay the rent like they were open.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, some rain-out weeks it was not good because he paid the rent and couldn't sell because they weren't open.
Sure.
But in the long run, it was great. You know, we all had fun. And, you know, there was Bob Metcalf. Of course, you know, he's involved with the racetrack with,
yep.
you know, dedicating some of the streets and stuff there. Bob and myself, Timmy Schaefer, his father, he's on Schaefer Electric. You know, my brother Francis and myself, Scott Tesserario, we'd all get go up in the stands and actually sell the popcorn peanuts so people wouldn't have to go downstairs.
Wow.
And, we, you know, we have competition who can sell the most. I think back then, I think it was like 6 cents a bag for everyone you sold.
Oh, wow.
Like 6 cents a bag. That's how the price differences are from the 70s till now. But, no, it's a lot of fun, you know, and it was Harry was really good to my family also.
Harry was a great guy. And, you know, I talked on the last show when I was memorializing Art Bennett about the fact that if it weren't for Harry's vision to see that these things with wings that showed up in the very early 60s to run against all of the, you know, the coupes and the coaches, the sportsman cars that Oswego ran, Oswego wouldn't be a super modified track. Who knows where it would be right now? It's incredible to think that, you know, basically one man's vision led to all that, right? And Harry, as a promoter, I feel like Harry had it. Harry understood it. Harry understood entertainment. And, you know, and the more that I hear about how he related to the people that worked for him, he understood how to treat them as well. You know, he took good care of them for the work that they put in, which, you know, that says a lot about who Harry was. And it sounds like your dad was a part of that. I feel like he was doing that for a lot of years, wasn't he?
Yes. As far as the concessions.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember how long, but it was quite a long time we did it.
Yeah.
Until the point, you know, I think there's to the sale, a change of hands.
Ah, okay.
Basically, and then the things changed.
Okay. So, yeah, that was a long time. That was longer than I would have realized. Now, how did it end up that your parents ended up with Harry's house, basically his mansion? How did that come about?
Well, basically, you know, the house was never lived in. He had visions. You know, he had the Speedway restaurant and did very well with that.
Yeah.
But he had visions of having entertainers come to the track and actually stay in the house.
Oh.
And, you know, he had great vision, like you said, but it just never happened. So the house was empty, and then Romy Caruso basically, you know, they put it up for sale and just kept dropping the price. And Romy was actually raced gigs with us up on the hill years ago, and he knew my dad, and he knew my dad had a, you know, great job with Niagara Mohawk and the nuclear power plants. And he said, hey, we're going to sell the house. And basically my mom and dad made an offer and it worked. And, you know,
wow.
They moved in. It was a lot of good memories at that. For us as kids, we're actually older kids then, but, you know, for my mom and dad to have that house was really a great thing for my dad. For all his hard work and all of the years, it paid off to have a beautiful place like that.
Boy, I can only imagine. I mean, I was lucky enough, Kevin and I both, when at some point just after they bought it, he gave us a tour, and I think my mother was with us too, and I just was blown away. Like, at the time, I'd never seen anything like that. It was the nicest house I'd ever seen, and I can only imagine what Christmases, for example, were like there, you know, with the way that house was and the space you had to put trees up and whatever else. It must have been incredible to have family gatherings in that place.
Oh, it was definitely, you could bring as many people as you want.
Yeah.
It held a lot of people. You know that, big house.
Yep, for sure. I mean, your mom just sold that, didn't she, not long ago?
I want to say it was 2015.
Yeah. Okay. So
maybe 14, 15.
Yeah.
you know, it was just so much for my mom and dad, and my dad's health was not good.
Yeah.
So my mom downsized, and it was just the opportunity when I believe the Teresi's bought the track from Mr. Furlong and Mr. Joya.
Okay.
That, you know, my mom actually approached them and basically made a deal, and it was a win-win because they had the track and the house and the property, which really helps them today with, you know, for parking for all the dirt week and campers and stuff.
Sure.
So it really worked out good for Tracy's.
Absolutely. And some great memories for the Carsons as well. Okay. So that brings us to your involvement as a car owner. Now, you mentioned racing gigs when you were a kid, and I did that once, and what an experience that was. I think most of us that are probably listening to the show at some point or other, if we're old enough to have been around at that time, we did that, and I think they brought it back for a while, just not here awfully long ago, but how did you get involved? What made you want to get involved as a car owner? I know that you were involved a little bit with Justin Shea on in the limited supers, and I was excited to kind of help make that happen. But what made you decide to jump in and actually own a race car?
It's funny. Of course, I used to sit in the stands every week.
Yeah.
And it was just at Shea car number 27. It was built by Freddie Graves, and I think Randy Riskus drove it. Russ Wood drove it.
Yeah.
And Russ Wood would go up to the track, and I just watched that car. And I said, you know, if I were going to buy a car, that's the car I would buy. And about a year later, Ed Shea put it up for sale, and I heard he put it up for sale, and I called him up, and he made me a deal I couldn't refuse.
Wow.
And I bought the car, and it really worked well. I didn't have a motor at that point, but I found a motor and basically didn't know what I was going to do because I don't know anything about setting the car up or whatever.
Right.
So immediately Paulie Coloca approached me and said, hey, you know, Joey Hawksby would be a good person to help with the car, and you might want to give him a call. So I bought the car back in 2002. And basically, believe it or not, I actually drove the car on May 25th of 2002. I actually took the car out, which it was pretty funny because I never drove before.
And wow.
I came out of the pit gate, and I made it about 20 feet and spun the car out because, number one, the tires weren't the best, but I didn't realize how much horsepower was underneath my foot.
Nobody does.
And I actually drove it one race that year. I think it was the 2 weeks after I bought it, I took it out in a heat race and made about 10 laps, and I didn't get in trouble and stayed out of trouble, and I knew that I didn't want to cause any problem, and I pulled it in, and I knew that I wasn't going to be a driver, and so basically Joe Hawksby took over in July of 2002, and he basically ran it all year.
Wow.
And he basically had to change the car over, by the way, too. I forgot this when I first bought it. Caruso, Romy banned the independent front suspension.
Right, okay.
And that had a leaf spring in the front for independent front suspension, and I couldn't run it. So I was a little upset.
I can imagine.
But, you know, yeah. They basically, Joe Hawksby, I'll tell you what, if you ever get a chance, the opportunity to talk to him, he learned a lot about independent front suspension from that car.
Sure.
Converting it over and putting a straight axle in it, but understanding the independent front suspension with the leaf spring and all the rates and how to set it up. And like you said, the year he drove it and the first year I bought it, you know, he had a couple 15ths, a couple 20ths, and a 7th. He ran the Classic that year and finished 17th. But, you know, we all learned from that. Because it wasn't the same car that I bought. He
right.
basically had to take the independent off and put a straight axle in it and go forward after that. And then in 2003, I approached Randy Riskus to drive it, and he drove it one night. I really don't remember how he finished, but he drove it one night, and then the following week, Johnny Payne drove it, and then he finished 20th. And then in 2003, the Classic, actually, Dave McKnight drove it, and believe it or not, he loved the car. He'd love to talk to you about it sometime. He basically, I think we started top 15 for the Classic.
Yeah.
And we ran he was running top 10 when an accident occurred, and he spiked the brakes. He got hit from behind, and he got put up on the first turn wall, and the bumper was holding the rear end up.
Oh,
so he lost a couple laps, and his emotions got the best of him, and he basically came out and on a vengeance, and he actually lapped the field to get one lap back. And we ended up finishing 20th in the Classic. But he was so excited. He said that was the best car he's ever driven, and he said he would have won the Classic that year. He said, hands down, he said, car handled well. He just, you know, again, it was late in the race, and what are you going to do? You're two laps down. He did the best you could do.
Would have been the second driver in super modified history to make up two laps to win the Classic behind Nolan Swift. Unless you ask Warren Conium, and then Dave would have been the first. But that's a different show. So, that was quite a run. And I remember Joey's run in the Classic, too, with it. And it was just very steady. I thought Joey did a nice job.
He did.
You know, and one of his... sometimes it's not about where you finish. It's about how. And I just thought he got the most out of the car and didn't do anything silly. And then Dave obviously showed what the car was capable of. Now, you started in 2004. Did Dave start the season in it? Because I know at some point Joe Gozick got in it.
Nope. In 2004, we started the season with Joe Gozick.
Okay.
It was great for – it was a win-win for everybody. First of all, Joe had his own crew.
Yep.
Joe had some great sponsors with Burke's Home Center. And, you know, I basically didn't – I wasn't a high-buck guy, but it was a great car. Everybody knew it was a good car. And just having Joe's crew and his craftsmanship as far as being a machinist and just the sponsorship, it was – and we all intertwined so much. We had so much fun. That was probably the most fun I've ever had in racing with Joe Gozick and the crew.
I can imagine.
Al Archer was on the crew, and, you know, it was just really fun. And, you know, it's funny because Danny Harrington always says to me, he says, boy, I'll tell you, of all the years I raced with Joe Gozick, he said, when you had that car and we won 9 features in that with that car and a lot of heat races, he said that was the most fun he's ever had with Joe Gozick.
Wow. Well, I mean, you guys had tremendous success together. And I think, you know, Joe was really, I mean, you think about where Joe was in the 90s. I mean, he started 1980, so he'd already had 10, 15 years experience. You know, the 90s, that was when he went Indy and did the 500. And, you know, and just he was really, to me, you know, basically at the peak of his career. And I didn't remember that you guys won so many races together, but I knew that you'd won and were just super fast. You know, and I can only imagine for Joe, you know, that was a great opportunity because he didn't have to worry about maintaining his own car.
Yes, it was, like I said, it was a win-win. With the, you know, the crew, both crews coming together and just the sponsorship. And it was just, like I said, we had a lot of fun. You know, it's the only car that Joe Gozick ever won on Burke's Night, sponsored.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah, it's the only Burke's Night that Joe won was in my car. He also won a big 75-lap race.
Yep.
We were running, and he came, I think he started like 6th, Furlong started like 8th, and they were both going at it back and forth. And I believe Gene Lee Gibson had a lot of laps in the front with Steve Miller's car. And it was like lap number 24, 25 out of 75. Furlong pass, Gozick on the outside, and actually came up for the lead, going for the lead. And Jennifer Chesbrough was at lap car on the outside. And Furlong was going out. He slammed on the brakes, and Gozick ran in the back of him, and they both went into the wall.
Oh, wow.
Ordway was running like 5th. He also hit the inside hub rail. So he had to go in the pits. Furlong was out for the night, and Gozick had to go in for some checkout, just check the car out.
Okay.
So Furlong couldn't come back to race that night for the 75-lapper, and Joe was able to come back out and start in the rear. And Joe ended up winning that night. 75-lap race coming back from the back of the pack. And it was really exciting. I know there was some emotions with Greg and you know, with everybody apologized. It was a racing incident. But, you know, I don't know if Joe would have beat Greg that night, but it would have been a great race to watch. those two go at it.
For sure. Well, and again, the competition at that point was so stout, and to have that kind of success in that era, you know, really says a lot about the team that you had around you to be able to do all of that. And, you know, how much fun was that just as a car owner to be able to kind of sit back and watch that magic happen for so long that season?
It was great. Like you said, I always sat in the stands, and then you own a car owner, you're in the pits. Yeah, you don't get to see as much when you're in the pits. But,
sure.
You know, it's just the emotions, the rush, you know, it's just in the watching everything from the pits with everybody standing around. And it was just a lot of fun. You know, I don't regret any of it at all.
So what happened with that partnership? Because eventually, obviously, that came to an end.
What happened is, you know, the car was getting to the point, you know, is an older car, and people were coming out with newer cars, and it got to the point Joe felt that it really wasn't competitive anymore.
Okay.
And he didn't want a new car, and he got together with Robbie Gunther and Scotty's Towing and Al Archer, and they decided to, I believe they bought an Extreme car, and
They
went on their way, and I actually put my car up for sale, and I sold it to, I believe it was Travis Bartlett. One of the Bartletts bought it from Mexico.
Okay.
And I don't think he ever raced it. He hung on to it for 6 months to a year, and then he sold it to, I think his last name is Daggett. He actually sponsors Bellinger's crew.
Okay.
He bought the car. It actually still sits in Eddie Bellinger's garage. They ran a couple ISMA shows with it. It was really strange because last year they brought it out with a new tail section wing on it, and it
really
actually turned like a 16.3 lap.
No kidding.
Right out of the box, and I was like, I wasn't sure it was my car. I could tell by the roll cage, and I went over afterwards, and they said, yeah, the car is a great car.
Wow.
It's still a good car. And I think if they ever change the tail sections back to the older ones, and I think the shocks are better, tires are different, I think the car can – is it a top three car? Probably not. Top 10? Absolutely. You know,
wow.
Somebody wanted to start racing and buy that car, it'd be a great starter car for somebody. I don't know if he's got it up for sale or not, but I approached him a couple times, and he really wasn't ready to sell it. So,
oh, gosh, you'd think he'd rather sell it than just leave it sit. That's not
doing
anybody any good, right?
It just sits there. It is.
Yeah.
It just sits there.
Yeah.
So
crazy. Wow, that's incredible. You had a good run, and then, of course, you were out of it for a while as an owner. And then a few years ago, you and I saw each other over Christmas, and you told me that that your son was thinking about racing, and it didn't happen that year. It was the following year that you guys, or he bought a car and started racing SBS. How did all that sort of develop?
Well, I think it was basically Robbie Gunther's son, Ryan, basically came to my son, Jonathan, and said, hey, we should do this.
Okay.
Ryan raced go-karts. Jonathan really never raced anything.
That's what I thought.
And Jonathan decided to do it, and he bought a car. And, of course, I really wasn't too familiar with the SBS, the setups and stuff like that, but I wanted to learn.
Right.
So, you know, he did pretty good for, you know, his first year. Believe it or not, he had a podium finish, which was basically by attrition. But, you know, he did it for a year. And I do believe, you know, he sold his car and he really wants to get back in it. I'm hoping that if he does, we go, you know, small block super. I just think I'd do better with that. But, yeah, he did it. And he actually went to number 27 because I,
yeah,
with Justin Shea, number 27.
Yep.
And I always
those were
loved the
days.
Number 27. So he actually took the number 27 for himself. And like you said, he ran a year and ended up selling the car. And so when he did buy that car and he did race it, we were missing like scales. We were missing some different parts, you know, with backup parts, whatever,
sure,
pit cart. And I heard, and we needed a new trailer, so I heard that Mr. Bartlett, the one who bought my car, 27, the Super, has some stuff for sale. So I ended up going out and seeing him and end up, without the trailer, but I ended up getting an SBS myself.
Yeah.
And it wasn't on purpose. It just basically, I bought the whole package and the car came with it. At that point, you know, didn't have a motor, know nothing about it, and Chip Wood approached me and said, hey, Jeff, what are you going to do with your SBS? I says, I don't know why. He said, well, I got a driver that would love to try it. Mike Fowler, he's a dirt guy.
Yep.
You know, he's got some guys that can help him. He said, you might want to think about putting him in the car. So I sat and talked to Mike, and put a deal together, and it was great because, you know, he had a great shop. He had all the tools and equipment. He had the crew. I went and got a good motor for it, and everything really, you know, he had fun again, having fun, hanging out, and enjoying the races every week. We had an up-and-down year with some things and motor issues and stuff, but overall, I don't regret it at all, and I still have the car, and I'm thinking about putting a big driver in it. We haven't confirmed yet. I'm hoping we'll know in the next day or two.
Uh-huh.
And, I don't want to really give the name out until we decide if it happens. But if it doesn't happen, you know, the car is for sale. Unless somebody wants to approach me with some type of deal, doing the same, you know, bring a driver in with some sponsorship or something, I'd consider doing that. But right now the car's pretty much ready to go for this season.
Okay, so breaking news, Mike Fowler no longer in the 10, and potential big-name driver stepping into the 10 for 2024, so stay tuned to the groove. We may have some news for you on the next show, also car for sale if somebody wants to buy it or somebody wants to, you know, you got sponsorship or you got something that you can bring to the table here, maybe a possibility. So that's all very interesting to know that. Did Mike decide just to go back to the Sportsman?
He actually has another ride. I don't know if it's – I really don't know the particulars if it's a big black dirt or not, but I know he's going to be doing a lot of dirt racing.
Okay.
And, you know, two different cars, and he just doesn't have the time, to be honest with you, to come in. He did – I'll tell you what. He told me that he loves the asphalt fans. He loves the asphalt, you know, pit crew and everybody basically having fun and hanging in the pits. He gained a lot of friends, and I think he even got some sponsors out of the deal. You know,
that's great.
It's just a win-win for him. I got some of his friends, and it was just a great thing. It's all about racing and having fun, you know?
Racing really, that's the beauty of it, isn't it? It's really about the people and the friendships and the relationships that you build over the years. And I feel like, you know, yourself, your dad, you know, your family has been so tied to Oswego and the Supers. And it's like I say on this show a lot, the generational thing doesn't just happen with drivers. It's, you know, crew people and officials and whatever, you know, and once it's in your blood, there is no getting it out.
No,
you know,
no. I agree with you there.
You know, it's
a disease.
Yeah, it's definitely, and there is no cure for this addiction, and I'm okay with that, quite frankly. You know, and no matter what, you know, the situation is, I mean, we all know, you know, the super modified division is it's trying to sort of revive itself and refresh and restart itself, and there's a lot of people who are doing a fantastic job, in my opinion, of pointing it back in the right direction after I think it kind of got lost for a while. But, you know, it's just been so much fun to grow up around that. And, you know, I've been blessed enough to be able to make a living from it for, you know, for a good while now. And even when I was doing something else full time, you know, racing was still a very big part of my life, and I pray that it always will be. You've had a lot of different sort of interests and situations in your life, but I think the time that you spent with the dealership, I mean, you were to me, you were exactly the right personality and the right sort of people person to have, you know, to be in that business, but. That's just a really crazy business to be in. What, talk a little bit about your time owning the dealerships.
Well, it's funny because I worked at the nuclear power plant. Niagara Mohawk sold the steam station.
Yep.
And basically what happened is it was a union shop. So a lot of the people that worked at the steam station wanted to keep their time in with the company. So they basically bumped back to the nuclear power plant.
Oh.
And I was one of the ones that basically got bumped out of my position because of time for the union.
Okay.
And nice. Decided, you know what, I think I'd really like to get in the car business. Don't ask me why I wanted to, but I did. And Russ Cook Ford and Wolkett was for sale, and basically talked to him a little bit, And if it wasn't for the help of, you know, some people that I know, basically talked to Harold Nye up in Oneida and said, hey, you know, this young kid, he's 30 years old, wants to buy a Ford store. He really needs somebody to support him. You know, you were a long time business with relationship with Ford. Can you help him out? And I actually went to his dealership for a couple different weeks, hung out there and learned the business. And he basically signed for me for Ford. If I needed any help, he'd be there to help me.
Wow.
And thanks for Harold Nye and Billy Nye, because I bought a Ford dealership in 1995. And basically the whole issue I really had is, didn't have the experience, and it just takes so much capital. People don't realize how much money it takes. You know, back then, you know, look at the price of cars back then versus they are now.
Yeah, I can't even imagine what it'd be like
if
now.
If you're not a big multimillionaire, there's no way, or big corporation, there's no way you're going to get a franchise dealership today. It's just, it just takes too much money.
Yeah.
And a lot of floor plan, a lot of money. And, you know, it was quite the education for me. I really had a lot of friends and had a lot of fun, but the stress of, you know, it just takes so much time and energy and money to do it. And I had the opportunity to sell it to Don Cole and all the Cole Muffers. He decided to approach me, and he bought Jay Robinson out in Red Creek, and they wanted to build a new store on 104 next to me. They wanted to buy the land. And I said, you know, would you be interested in buying me just for the fact that I don't want another competition in my backyard? So he ended up making a deal, and I sold it to Don Cole for Mark Fernandez, and he built a new Chrysler Plymouth Dodge Jeep store out there, and that was pretty much it. So I just stuck with the used cars and a Swiggo.
Okay.
And I did that until 2015, when I decided to basically, I wasn't forced out of my location because I had a good tenant, but I decided to basically get out of the car business and go back to the nuclear business, which I did back in 2015.
Okay. All right. And yeah, you were in the car business for quite a long time, and I think people would be curious to understand more about how it actually does work with a floor plan and all that, because I don't think people really realize, you know, it's not like cars just show up on the lot and then you sell them and you make money. You're buying the cars, you're paying for that inventory, right? And isn't it, doesn't it get more expensive because you're paying for the time that car sits on the lot, kind of thing?
Well, you know, basically, you know, you get delivered from the manufacturer. What Ford would basically drop a car off, you know, the first 30 days, you don't have to basically pay for the car. It's,
right.
It's put on your floor plan, you know,
right.
it's coming in transit type deal. And then once you receive the car, it's basically the meter starts ticking at 30 days, 31 days, you're starting to accumulate interest on that car. And then, of course, basically being a new car, they would let you floor plan it for 6 months to a year, depending on the price, and you basically work your deal out. But you're paying interest. Like back then, interest is probably 7-8%. So, you know, you got $1 million worth of inventory, you're paying floor plan on $1 million worth of inventory at that percentage rate for interest. And
every
so,
month.
You know, some of these dealers today, you know, there's some dealers that have $20 million worth of inventory right now.
Yeah.
The floor plan's like 6-7% interest. And, you know, you're paying $120,000, $130,000 a month to have your car sit there.
Crazy.
So basically, if you sold a car, made $1,000 profit, and you sold 120 cars, you didn't make any money at all because it all goes to the bank for the interest.
Yeah, see,
so, you know, today it's just, it's tough. It's, you know, it's a lot of work. A lot of people, and, you know, like I said, it's just a lot of stress, and I don't know if some of these dealers, how they actually do it, to be honest with you.
I don't either. I mean, especially like you said today with the price of things, and, you know, it's, and you think, well, if somebody sells, you know, an $80,000 truck, you know, they're making bunches of money. No, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, that's it. And that, even that sounds like a lot, but it's not when you start looking at these other costs. It's just crazy. The car business is such a unique and crazy business. I enjoyed the time that I spent with you out there and everybody just learning and understanding it more. And, you know, I love the business. I think it's fun to, you know, to deal with the customers. And you were always, I've just never, there aren't too many dealership owners that are as hands-on as you were and that treat the customers the way that you did. I saw more than one time when you, you know, had something come to you from certain other dealerships where the customer was getting ripped off and you were able to sort of get them out of that and get them into something at a lower price or lower interest rate and save them money. You know, you were always, again, that really fit your people style that you have. You like to help people and be good to people.
Yeah, to this day, I get people that are buying cars and they come to me and say, hey, you know, what's a good deal? What's my car worth? I love helping people.
Yep.
And what made me really in the business make it as long as I did is customer service.
Yep.
Services, you know, today these big dealers, independents, they're internet sales. You know, they're getting people from different states coming to buy their cars, and they never see them again. So I'm not saying they don't care about customer service, but, you know, they're basically making a profit off the car. They never see the car again,
sure.
Never see the car or the customer again, where I was, you know, picking people's car up at work. I mean, I had six drivers on the road every day going to Rochester Kodak, going to 9 Mile 1 or 9 Mile 2, or going to Novelis, which was Elkan at the time. I had drivers every day picking cars up, dropping cars off. It, you know, it was nice for doctors and lawyers to call me and say, hey, can you take my car up? It needs an oil change and this and that. And I have a driver go right to his office, pick it up, do it, bring it back. And I think that's really helped my business make it as long as I did was customer service, you know, because I really didn't have a lot of inventory. I didn't have a lot of money to have inventory, but service was the key and kept me going as long as I did and had some great technicians. You know, all my guys, when I sold out, you know, two of them went to Novelis, you know, two went to National Grid for mechanics. You know, all my guys that were good mechanics bettered themselves in the field of, you know, benefits and retirement, going to good places because of their work ethic and working for me. And it was great. You know, everybody won.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, for those listening to this, Jeff was so good at what he did, he talked my father out of his Chevy. And if you knew anything about my father, there was no Fords that were happening in his lifetime. He was always a bow tie guy. And, you know, I mean, some of it might have been because I worked there. But Jeff, you know, they had a couple of Tauruses, and those were nice cars. And great times. And, you know, I learned a lot about customer service from watching how you and Wes did things. And, you know, it was very instructive and things that I still, you know, still use today and have used since. And so just fun. And you look back across the years and, you know, you're just blessed to have those opportunities, but you've been around Oswego Speedway for so long and you're still involved there. Now, if you sell the car, if you sell the 10 car, what do you do next? Do you go buy another car? What do you do?
Well, I'll probably be with Robbie Gunther's son, Ryan. He's got, believe it or not, he's got three cars.
Oh,
I don't know what's going on this year, if he's going to put somebody in it or it's just going to drive one himself and have a backup. But, yeah, Ryan's got three cars, and I'm basically in the pits helping him.
Okay.
Doing stuff that I've learned from the last couple of years in the pits on the SBSs. And then I'm hoping that down the road you get a small block super is what I'm hoping for.
Okay, so 350 and possibly in the future. So is that Jonathan's next ride, or do you buy one and put somebody else in it? Because I think we can form you a pretty quick line of drivers waiting for you to make that purchase.
Well, I think I'd want a car that, you know, again, there's a car in mind that I have right now that I'd love to buy.
Okay.
That's very successful. They came here to run the small block super. And then I would put a definitely a good driver in it. And then, you know, put my son in after that. You know, I always would want the best of the best jump in it and say, hey, car is great. Jump in it. This is how it's supposed to be. You know, if you've never driven a car like my son, John, you know, I was kind of tough on him, to be honest with you. And I had my words with him because he, you know, gets frustrated. I expected too much out of him because he never drove.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, I just think that I just more familiar with the Supers than I am the SBSs. And I would like to have, you know, somebody going to set it up, learn some more with the small block and the way the setup is, and then go that route and to play with the SBSs.
Well, I mean, as far as 350s go, your relationship with Joey Hawksby could come in handy again there, I would think.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And
yes.
he's got talent out there.
He's the best of the best. Man. You know that. He's learned a ton, and he's great. He helps a lot of people.
Yeah.
He's helped that class tremendous with his own son. you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, and Talon did I thought Talon did a great job last year. He improved from the beginning to the end of the year a lot and, you know, had a little time the year before, but last year, first full year. And, you know, I have the feeling that Talon's going to come out this year and, you know, and he's going to contend for wins and even a championship, I think, because, you know, he's got a whole winter to sort of let the dust settle from the success that he started having toward the end. He knows he's got the speed. It's just figuring out, you know, the passing and all of that that you got to get the hang of. And once you get that and you got the car, then that's the recipe to start winning. So,
I agree with you. I just wish, you know, with this MAC team and this Swiggle, I hope they can come to some common ground and make things work. I mean,
yeah.
I always believed that this is the way to go. For everybody.
I agree.
And it's sad that it's divided right now. And, you know, I just hope something comes together to make it everybody wins, because right now I hate to have two separate class based on motor, you know, right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like with the big box, you had Isma and you had Oswego and the motors were different, slightly, you know, different, you know, Isma wanted to twist the motors more or whatever. It's kind of the same deal, built versus crate, or spec or whatever. And, you know, I think, you know, we talked to Jimmy Smith from the Mighty TQ Midgets last week on the last group show. And he was talking about how there's four or five different TQ clubs and they all, you know, one club runs wings, the other one doesn't, the third one runs wings, but they're bigger, you know, you have different, but when it came time to do the big show in Florida, a few weeks ago during Speed Weeks in Auburndale, all the drivers from all the clubs came together with a specific set of rules, no wings, you know, to fit Auburndale and to fit that show. And, you know, I'd at least like to see that. It's kind of, okay, during the season we can do our thing, but then there's times like the Oswego Classic. We love to have them in Florida at Auburndale. You know, when everybody could come together with a package specifically tailored to, you know, those shows where, you know, everybody can be on an even playing field and have a good time. And I really hope that happens, because the big blocks have started to find the common ground. And you can see the growth in the interest just in the last, you know, year or so. You all of the buzz that's happened since ISMA and MSS got together and, you know, in Oswego and what Nikotra's done, right? So
he's been great.
Yeah.
He's been really huge. He's been great. Really has.
Yeah. I mean, John has just been incredible. So, you know, I agree with you, though. I'd like to see, because the 350s, I feel like that's a type of car that's, I think the price point is good to get into it and be competitive. And I think that's the type of car that you could take around the country and start building if you could come up with, you know, sort of a model for this is what the 350 is, and you can make it so that you know, you can build enough cars to start, you know, blowing up the fields around the country. You know, I think the way that race car is, it would be super exciting to watch. And I think you take it into an area that doesn't have a lot of open wheel, open cockpit stuff, and I think people would go nuts just like they do here every time. You know, the Supers show up, and I'm glad they're coming back again in the fall, because the fans down here, I've already heard fans talking about it. Like, there's people excited about the fact that the Supers are coming back to the North-South Shootout. They can't wait to see them again. So I think that's going to be a big deal.
I just think they need to two things. Slow them down a little bit. I think these cars are going too fast. Even the 350 Supers at Oswego Speedway, they're just – I really worry – they're just so fast with that size tire on them.
Yep.
And my fear is have a wing break, something breaks, and they hit the wall. They're just going so fast. I mean, these J350s are, you know, the speeds they're doing is back when, you know, I mean, you talk about a regular in the 70s and the 80s with they're so much faster than a super back then.
Oh, well,
I just think they're, you know, these cars, even Swiggle Speedway Supers on non-wings, are just it's no racing. It's just so fast. You only need to go so fast, you got to turn left. I just think these cars need to be slowed down a little bit, and I think be more competitive. And I think they're changing the right front tire, I heard, for the Supers this year, make it a wider tire, so it'll help them turn a little bit. But still, you know, you got to slow down to turn. But I don't know what they're going to do. I just think that if this class gets together, the 350, I think that's going to help. And I think the Super, as I said, they are changing stuff to, I think, slow them down a little bit and make it more competitive to pass. At least that's what they're talking about. We'll see this year how things pan out. But I think it's definitely – everything's going in the right direction at this point.
See, I
think,
I
like you said, with the midgets talking about it, and I think everybody's starting to realize that, you know, it's a lot of money, you know, and a lot of time. And if they can get these cars to slow down and have some competitive racing every week,
yep,
people will come back.
Yeah.
People will come back.
Well, that's the key. I think you got to – and I don't know so much if the speed – I think what you need is a car that can race around other cars, and the more downforce and all of that that you give it, and you see it all over the sport. NASCAR's having the same issue. How do we – you know, we're going to Phoenix this weekend with the Cup cars with a much smaller spoiler, a smaller rear diffuser. All of that is designed to basically reduce downforce and make the cars grip less, you know, so that hopefully the drivers can drive them better. And you know, it's always tough because, I mean, no matter how fast you go, if you slow everybody down a second, you know, yeah, it makes them all, hopefully everybody slows down the same, right? But you're still going to have this, but it's the idea that right now there's just so much downforce that the cars can't run in easily past other cars. I think if you make them, and it's like I said, you know, I've said before, you kind of got to make them suck more. You got to make them handle worse. You got to make them less drivable, because that's what allows the drivers to be able to control the car with their feet. And I think the new tire, from what I hear, is going to make the driver manage the car and the tires a little differently, a little softer. And then with the changes in the wing angle, it's all designed to kind of make for a better, you know, racing passing package. And, you know, then we just got to get more cars, because 15 cars on the track in Oswego is not much. It's a big track. So, you know, you need to get back up to 20, 25, 30, and then you get good racing, because you get traffic and, you know, all of that entering into it, not so much with the fields they have. So
it's funny you say that, the car count. I mean, back in 2003, 4, and 5, it's classic weekend. Classic, 35 cars started Classic.
Yep.
35 cars started the Classic.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, went from 40 to 34, and now we're, like, happy if we get to 30, right? It's like, and it's, you know, on the one hand, obviously, you want to celebrate the fact that we still have them at all, but on the other hand, you still want to see it be able to grow, and you understand that to do that, you need new people into the class. And so I think that's really where you start working, and you know, we get somebody like yourself, even in the 350, you know, I celebrate the ones like you who own cars for other people to drive, because there's not enough of you anymore, you know. Right. And we need more of you, because that's how more drivers get a chance to move up and play. And you look at some of the guys even that came out of the what were then called limiteds back in the day, somebody like Bob Gutermout, you know, if it weren't for Darcy Kerfeen and that group, probably Bob wouldn't have raced the Super, and look how well he did. You know, I mean, we were blessed to have him in that division, and he added a lot to it. You know, so it's tough. We're right at that point, but with what they're doing and with the buzz that's going on around the Supers, I think we're, like I said, I feel like it's, and you said it too, headed back in the right direction, and that's a good thing, and a thing to celebrate going into 2024, because you know, we needed that, and hopefully these changes will work well. But Jeff, it's been great to catch up with you, and just kind of let you tell your story a little bit, and let us celebrate not only your involvement but your family's involvement as well in Oswego and in the Super Modified community. Like you said at the beginning, there were a bunch of us that just, I mean, gosh, your poor dad probably got tired of me calling every 2 hours on Wednesdays during the summer, wondering when the program's coming in, and then wanting to know who was on the cover. I have no idea why I was that nerdy, but I always wanted to know who was on the cover, and he would always tell me. You know, being able to get down and have that moment. And, you know, I remember seeing you and seeing I think it was Francis. I don't know if I remember meeting Mark back in those days, but I know I met you and Francis. But just, you know, being able to have that experience and now to have a bunch of those old programs and realize that you're looking at stuff that's over 50 years old in some cases, it's just incredible. So
where did time go?
Oh, gosh, I don't know, but it seems like it goes by faster every year, and you just had another birthday. You got to stop having those or you're going to get old.
Oh, thanks a lot, buddy. I thought we were friends.
I discontinued birthdays about 6 years ago due to lack of interest. I just stopped having them. You know, I'm like, it doesn't happen anymore. So look forward to seeing what you do, you know, in 2024 or if the 10 car comes out. And you know, hopefully if you still have it, somebody will be in it.
If I don't sell it, somebody will be in it. Like you said, it's funny what number did I pick. 27 was already taken. My son sold his car, so number 27 was already picked. So I said, well, my dad was a Swifty fan. We'll just go with number 10.
I wondered how you got to the 10, and now it makes sense, right?
That was the only reason I picked Ben. Yeah. My dad was a Swifty fan.
That's fair. You know, it'd be cool, actually, to if you're going to run it again, it'd be cool to see a wrap on that car that resembles a Swift car.
I would do that on a 350. I think that'd be pretty
neat. I think it would be
modified. I don't know how it would turn out on SBS.
Oh, I think you could make it look good. The Hevron, the car that Greg Richardson had, that was the Hevron lookalike, that was beautiful. You know,
yeah, it was.
I think
it
people was. Would love to see, even if it is an SBS. I mean, they're not quite shaped the same as the Super, but in a way, if you look at the way they are now, they have some, at least, resemblance to the older Supers that we grew up watching. So, you know, I think it'd be cool to be able to do a Swift retro, and I think it would be very popular with the fans. So I'm just going to leave that with you.
How did you like the remake that they did of the 10?
Oh, Steve Miller?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
It was in the pits. Before the races started that day, I went in the pits, I walked over, and I literally started crying.
I bet.
I did.
Yeah. Kind of like me, probably, with the deuce and the eight balls.
From my dad, I said, I went over I just talked to Steve Miller and them. I said, boy, I wish my dad could see this. I just wish my dad could see this car.
Yeah. I haven't seen it in person, actually, because I haven't I was away from, I've watched all the classics, so I've seen the car and pictures and photos and whatever, but I've never seen it in person yet. I think it was either last year or the year before that Danny Kaye got to get in it, and I think he just warmed it up or something. I don't think he actually drove it. Even in that moment, like, I was so excited for Danny just to be able to take the car around because his dad was a big Swifty fan. Mike was always a Swift fan. So, like, again,
you got to remember, he used to come in the store also.
Did he?
His dad. Oh, yeah.
Very oh, no kidding.
My dad.
Yeah.
And we had the gigs. He was involved with the gig racing.
Oh, was he?
I came for, or by Fitcher Park School, his father.
Did he ever paint your gig?
No. Charlie Fader. And it was Charlie Fader and Johnny Coloca did the eight ball for Timmy Schaefer.
Okay.
And I'm pretty sure Charlie Fader did the 10 pins for my dad as far as painting the scheme and stuff for it. And believe it or not, Teresi's have both cars in my mom and dad's old house, and my mom asked for them back this year, and my mom wants to have them redone.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
How cool is that?
Yep, she's going to have them redone.
Wow, that's cool. I love that. Who did you race with that we would know? Because I feel like your age and your group that you were with, like, were you racing with Romy?
The Romy Caruso, yes.
Wow.
We were mad, and hope Romy's not listening to this offense, but he had a weight advantage over going down the hill. So, you know, the faster you go, he had the weight advantage of going down Fitchu Park Hill. We also raced up by the old Bishop Cunningham High School, up by Riley School. We went down that, too. We raced.
Okay.
It was Romy, of course, Frank Novelli. There was a bunch of diehard Friggle fans at the racetrack that had their own cars, and I was really young. and scared to death when I was going down the hill.
I bet, because I was too. The one year I did it, the first time I went down, and my car had a handbrake. It was my cousin's old gig, and you know, I started wanting one, and he's like, well, you can just have mine. And I'm like, okay. So much to my parents' disapproval, we got it. And yeah, I ran it, and I remember I finished fourth in the race out of, I don't know how many there were. I beat at least half the field, so that wasn't too bad. But I, the first time I went down, it's like, holy moly, these things are fast.
And I had the 01 of Jack McGreedy, was it?
Okay.
That was basically, it had a top on the top. It had the roll cage, but it had a top on it.
Okay.
And I got in it, and the first time I came down, there's no brakes. There's none.
Oh.
You're driving a steering wheel. Your feet are enclosed. There's no way to stop. I came down the hill and tried to make a left-hand turn on Division Street, and the tires spun, and I hit a sewer manhole cover.
Oh.
And my chest went into the steering wheel. And I was pretty much done for me.
Wow. I hope you didn't hurt any Ninja Turtles when you hit that manhole cover. That's funny. Yeah, I mean, just thinking about, you know, because when we were kids, that's what it was, right? You were racing bikes, racing gigs, you know, we wanted to race something. I don't know why, looking back, I never really wanted to be a driver per se. I got to race go-karts a bit in my 30s, but... like, it was never a thing for me. I always loved, like, I think it's funny because I look back and you say, well, God had a plan. Because, you know, with the Matchbox cars, I'm announcing, I'm keeping points. Each room in the house is a different track. I got my own circuit, right? It's like, you know, and you just
That's
think,
great.
You know, you have no idea at 5 or 6 or 7 what your life. And for me to be doing what I'm doing now, you look back and go, well, that was all practice, right? It was all, you know, and that must have, there must have been some sort of a, because I never thought about it.
We didn't have cell phones back. We didn't have the, you know, the computer
Thank
technology
God.
Back then. That's what we did. We played with match cars. We did the Hot Wheel tracks
yes.
going down. You know, we went to Swiggle Speedway.
Slot car tracks.
They gave out checkered flags.
Yes.
They gave out, you know what I mean? They gave stuff out every week for kids. A lot of kids were involved in that track
yeah.
more than ever back in our era than they are now.
I agree. Yeah, I agree 100%. And it was just... I mean, it was just fun. It just, you know, and to sort of think about it now and look back on it, you know, and realize that there were seeds that were being planted at that point. You know, and even for you, I'm sure if somebody said to you at 6 or 7 years old that someday you were going to be a car owner, you probably would have laughed, you know. And
well, you said we had a lot of great memories. Everybody
yeah,
did.
Absolutely.
Like you said, the kids. Harry was a smart man. I mean, he knew what he was doing.
He did.
He got the kids involved to stay in the track, to come to the track every week.
Well,
he wanted the fan count. He made money. He did good. He was good. Good promoter. He was a great guy.
And I don't know if they still do it, but I know back in the day, the other thing that I look back, and of course, when you're a kid, you don't think about the significance of this, but now looking back as an adult, I can see it. If you were a fireman or a policeman, you could get in on your badge. You
That's
know, that
correct.
Was, and I don't know if they still do that, but if they don't, they should. You know, because again, you know, and I've always said, if you can let everybody in free, now, of course, they lease the concessions out, so this isn't so much a formula anymore for them, but, you know, get them in for better. There's a butt in the seat for free than no butt in the seat because they're going to buy food. You know,
correct.
So you're going to make more money off of the concession. And of course, like I said, I don't know how all that works now with the fact that they're leasing them out. But, you know, Harry was a good promoter, and he understood that when the guys were traveling from like New England and whatever, I've heard multiple stories of, you know, put a little extra, you know, in their payout at the end if they had an accident
Travel.
Or whatever.
Yes,
yeah, to make sure that they could get back home, you know. You know, and I was at a go-kart race this past weekend at Charlotte, Cup Karts North America, which is their four-cycle, what they call sprint karts. They run on the short road course at Charlotte. I watched the owner of that series – a young man came out on the track and, and forgot his neck brace or whatever, and rather than sort of hold everybody else up while somebody ran back, you know, halfway across the lot to get the neck brace, he came in and off of the, they had a tent just inside the track area. He just came off the track, grabbed a brand new neck brace, brought it out and handed it to the kid. And I said, wow, you don't see nearly enough of that anymore, but you know, their whole philosophy is that they do everything they can to make sure that these racers can race. If they've traveled in to run their series, they want to. So they've got, I know there are stories about, you know, somebody breaks a part and nobody has one. Well, they've got a supply of miscellaneous parts. And you know, Gray has gone, and these are things that he probably won't want me sharing. But, you know, that's the kind of thing Harry used to do. You know, whatever it took to put on the show. And I think, you know, that's very instructive. And I think that's why you and I and so many other of us, you know, experienced people, not to say old, we grew up so attached to it, because the show that we saw back then was a product of Harry Caruso's mind and his vision and the way that he promoted things. And, you know, and I'd love to see us get more back to that.
Oh, I agree. I agree.
For sure. So, Jeff, again, so appreciate you taking some time and keep us informed of what's going to happen with the 10. We'd love to be able to let everybody know what's going on. And sounds like you've got somebody that you're waiting on a decision as far as a name that we probably all recognize. So, very curious to see where that goes, but, you know, I know that we're still going to see you around the track in some capacity one way or the other. And eventually I know you will find a way to buy a 350 if that's what you want to do, because that's how you've always worked. Whatever you,
oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Whatever you wanted, you'll work for it and figure a way out and a way in. So thanks for coming on the show, and, you know, wish you and your family a safe and successful 2024. Look forward to seeing you at the track.
Thanks. Same to you.
All right. That's Jeff Carson. We're going to step aside when we come back. We'll talk about what's going on with this brand new, not brand new, but new to me, facility that I'm in, and why there's a couple of cameras and a desk and table next to me. We'll tell you all about that in the next segment. Stay tuned. Okay, folks, I want to tell you about one of our sponsors here on Inside Groove, Indy Performance Composites. They're a premier composite design and manufacturing company creating performance parts and solutions for the automotive, aerospace, and communications industries. Jeff West and his team are amazing. They do all kinds of work in the motorsports industry, from dirt tracks to NASCAR to IndyCar, super modifieds. It doesn't matter. If you've got something that you need designed or fabricated, let them help you transform your idea, your vision, and your budget into a workable high-performance solution. They have all kinds of services, from 3D printing to finishing services. End-to-end composite solutions is what they are. Check them out, ipcindy.com or indieperformancecompositesinc.com, and tell them that the folks from Inside Groove sent you. Hey there, barbecue enthusiasts. Are you tired of boring sauces that leave your taste buds snoozing? Well, I've got something that'll make your mouth water and your ribs shout for joy. Wiggity Wayne Sauces. Wiggity Wayne Sauces brings you a complete line of barbecue sauces, ketchups, and rubs with flavors from mild to wild. They've got everything you need to take your grill game to the next level. Picture this. Juicy, succulent meat slathered in their mouth-watering habanero sauce, giving it just the right amount of kick. Or how about some lip-smacking, kicking hickory sauce that'll transport your taste buds straight to Flavortown? But wait, there's more. They've got apple pie moonshine sauce that'll have you thinking grandma's cooking up dessert on the grill. And for those who like it bold, their Carolina Bold sauce will have you shouting yee-haw with every bite. But hold on to your spatulas, folks. They've got an exclusive offer just for you. Visit WiggityWayneSauces.com today and get a mouth-watering 20% off your first order. That's right, 20% off. So don't sleep on this deal, folks. Head on over to WiggityWayneSauces.com and let your taste buds go wild with their amazing flavors. Your grill and your belly will thank you. Welcome back to The Groove as we get set to roll into our final segment here on this week's show. And hope you enjoyed the interview with Jeff Carson. It was a lot of fun to do and just really brought back a lot of memories. I had no idea that there were people who actually would wait in line at Carson's News to get the program. I had no idea that people would sit in their cars and wait for the program to show up. That's crazy. And it also makes me feel a little bit better about calling poor Mr. Carson every couple of hours to see if it was in yet. There were far more passionate people about grabbing the best two numbers in the racing game than me, which is that's a comfort. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on now. There's so much here. I'll try to keep this segment compact, but gosh, we got a lot to get to. I teased something at the end of the Carson interview that I guess I can start with that, and then we'll talk about some super modified stuff. I believe that I mentioned that we've got new facilities. This is the first full show that we have recorded here in terms of Inside Groove in our new office space, which is really half office, half studio. It's really quite a nice little space. It's in one of the parks, inside a building in one of the business parks where a lot of the race teams and motorsport-related businesses, automotive-related businesses, are located here in Mooresville, North Carolina. And we got it because, well, one, I really needed to get back to an office. Working from home is great, and it wasn't a discipline thing or any sort of, you know, my inability to focus on work. Because, you know, there's no wife, kids, or dog. Well, there is a dog, but I don't own it. it's in the apartment below me, and it barks at its own shadow, but we'll get to that later. So it just was a case of really needing to have a space. I kind of outgrew the space I had at home. And so we also wanted to launch this video show and do more with video. And you really have to have a place for, if you want guests to come and sit down, and a place for the producer to sit and the equipment and all of that. So it was time. And we were fortunate enough to be able to come into this nice space. And it has changed the Tom Baker Show a bit because there's a part two to this that I did not foresee when we came in here. About 2 days after we came in here, I had a conversation with the content development director for a quickly emerging streaming TV network. And this goes back to PRI. In December, I had met with a CEO. I say I met. I said hello and shook his hand. And then in typical PRI speed dating fashion, I think we got to tell me more about, and then someone more important than me dragged him away. So that's just how PRI is. There isn't a lot of quality time sometimes with people that you'd really like to have quality time with and do business. So, but it's fun nonetheless. And the seed was planted. So I ended up talking with the CEO's wife for a little while. I say little while. I think I got 40 seconds with her. long enough to grab a card. And then Brian, the CEO, was nice enough to call me back shortly after the PRI show. Typically, again, when you're And I mean, it's different for me with what I do, but most of the folks who actually have booths at PRI and spend a lot of time and money pre-show to sort of build up to that. And a lot of these same folks have come from the SEMA show, which happened shortly before. You know, they're ready to, it's on to holiday, right? I mean, they're done. The year's over. You know, tear the thing down, get on the plane, and, you know, go back home and find a place that's warm and cozy for the holidays, right? That's kind of how it all works. So usually you don't, you know, not too much happens between PRI and the end of the year. So you're really just sort of networking and glad handing, and, you know, you're hoping that something happens in January, but a lot of times, even by then, you know, companies have set their budgets and such and made all their decisions. So, you know, it's more of a show that probably is made for seeing the latest and greatest. And then, you know, you're almost a year ahead if you're trying to get any kind of business with somebody. Oftentimes you're, you know, PRI 23 would have been more about we're, you know, budget set for 24, but, you know, let's talk in the summer for 25. And that's kind of how all that works. Well, in this case, Brian, you know, of course, they've got this streaming network, and I'll tell you what it is and get to that in a minute, but I want to tell the story in a certain order for a certain reason. So, you know, he was nice enough to call me, I think, the week before Christmas. He touched base with me, and we set up a Zoom call and had a Zoom call and talked for a bit. And super nice guy and really sharp, very accomplished. They've got a good plan. And this network has only been online since June of last year. And they're currently today, they're already over 2 million hours of video viewed. So they've grown pretty quickly in terms of audience. They've got a lot of reach and a lot of different, what we call distribution sources. In other words, ways to access the network and their content. And had an initial conversation, and in my world, this was about a banner swap. You know, I wanted to sort of cross-promote, which is common in our business. If you can, you know, if you can cross-promote each other, two or more, that's basically a form of obviously free advertising, and it gets hopefully new audience for both sides. So we discussed that, and then he put me to his content development director, which the way that he explained it to me, this gentleman was kind of his right hand, so I'm just assuming that he's going to let his guy handle it. You know, what he said was, whatever you guys work out, just keep me in the loop, and, you know, and let's see what we can do. So that's what I thought was going to happen. But then we started to make plans for this video show, and it got hot. Things started happening. And so it looked like it was more imminent than I thought at first that it would be. So I said, okay, I'm just going to, you know, I'll call those guys back, but, you know, I'll wait a little bit till I can update them on the progress of the video show so that there's more, they feel like there's more of what I'm doing for them to actually promote. You know, there's more value in the cross promotion because I can, you know, put promotion in the video for them. That's, you know, so I didn't really respond for a bit. And about mid-January, the CEO pinged me again. And then mid-February or so, late February, he pinged me again. And just, you know, wanting to know how things were going and if I talked to Ray yet. Well, finally, Once we were in here in the space for a couple days, literally didn't even have the studio part built out yet. We didn't have the table or chairs or, you know, I brought the cameras in, but we, you know, we already had the equipment, but we just didn't have, we didn't have the furniture, and we still haven't painted the walls, which, is one of our next, items on the list here, is to repaint and decorate so that when we record something, it doesn't look like I'm sitting in a doctor's office in the background, because just plain sort of, you know, beige-colored wall. Finally got decided I would reach out to the content director. So now I'll kind of get more specific here. So the content director is the content director for a streaming network called PowerTube TV. If you used to watch Speed Channel, then you know that you will remember shows like Pink's and Pastime and Pink's All Out. I'm trying to remember names off the top of my head, and I'm going to fail at it. But at one point, four of the top five shows on the Speed Channel were produced by this particular gentleman. And so it is a group of people that are well experienced with content production, distribution, and obviously building an audience and putting out great stuff, because they built those shows for Speed Channel. Fox then bought Speed and acquired the shows, and now Brian, the CEO, and Ray, Brian bought all the shows back that they had produced, and then started what then last June was called SpeedTube TV. So it was basically meant to be a remake of Speed Channel, but in digital form, because of course in 2024, cable is not as much of a thing. Broadcast is not as much of a thing. It's a different world now. We all have phones that are computers and are connected to the internet. And we have TVs, which also have the internet built into them, or at least apps that are on the internet built into them. You know, they call them smart TVs, right? And so you have streaming services and streaming networks like Roku, which is astronomically large. I had no idea how many subscribers Roku has. And then, you know, you've got Hulu and YouTube TV and Sling, and I don't even remember them all offhand, but there's just a number of different places now where you can get current programming as well as past programming, and some of it is basically just general network stuff, like Hulu has a whole bunch of different stuff, and then there's streaming TV networks like PowerTube that are niched. They specialize in one type of programming, and in this case it's automotive related programming. And there's a word or a phrase that's attached to the type of network that PowerTube is, and it's called Fast TV, free ad supported television. And the word free is a key here, because that means it's free to view. It's free to watch. It's not like Flow Racing or Dirt Vision or, you know, one of the other subscription networks. PowerTube TV is entirely free to watch, and you can access it through their website. They have apps for both Android and Apple. They have, they're on Apple TV, they're on Roku, they're on Amazon Fire, I think that's what it's called. So there are a number of different ways to access the programming. And that's an advantage for the creator, because if someone's creating content for PowerTube TV and they're putting their content on PowerTube TV's network, that network includes all of those ways of accessing the content, right? So it's the same thing that SpeedSport has done with their new app called SpeedSport One. That is a fast TV app, free ad-supported TV app. There's no charge to you or me as a viewer of the content on the app. It is the expenses and the costs of producing the programming and, you know, having the network, which, by the way, are very high. Video is really expensive to do. I mean, sure, everybody can, you know, turn their camera on their phone and you know, and do a video and throw it on Facebook. But the type of production that that being on a network of that that level demands is not, you know, take your cell phone and shoot an interview, an hour interview, and put it up. That's not how that works. So that's one reason why I've been so slow in making the jump to video. It isn't out of any conceptual aversion to it. I have a face for radio, but that's okay. I mean, I don't mind looking into a camera. Feel bad for the viewer, but that's all right. Just close your eyes and just listen. But open them when the guest talks. But it's not that. It's just it's the cost of it. I have to have a producer because I can edit audio till the cows come home. I cannot. I'm not a video editor. And especially, again, when you're trying to have the type of quality that would be on a TV network, which is what this is. When you see these fast TV networks like this, I mean, you know, it is TV on the web. It's not social media. It's not YouTube, even though they have a YouTube. That, again, is another distribution source. It's just another place to put their network where the programming can be found by a different audience. And that's the advantage of these free ad-supported TV networks, is that, you know, they're generally comprised of a number of different places where people can get the content. So, at any rate, by the end of the conversation with their programming director, their content development director, we weren't talking about a banner swap or a cross promotion anymore. We basically, and this was something they initiated, I didn't. They actually told me that they launched this network last June with all of those classic shows, Pink's, Pigs All Out, Pastime. You know, there's a number of different shows, and then they've slowly started to add new content. And so they're really after motorsports more than the sort of builds and the, you know, the classic, I guess you'd call them, I don't even know, are they street outlaw? I don't even know really what the category is, but the, you know, the build the car and take it to the strip and, you know, so you do the Pink's thing or whatever. It's they're looking for more, you know, sort of, I don't even want to use the word mainstream, but just more motorsports related, you know? And so, when I described, they asked me what we were doing with video show and I described it, they were really keen to, you know, to figure out how to put the partnership together in a way that included the show. So we've talked twice, and then finally this past week, the agreement was signed. So Steering Wheel Nation is now a content developer, creator developer for PowerTube TV, which is absolutely insane. It's a little scary, to be honest, but this has been fun because we shot the pilot show for the Tom Baker show. We shot the pilot at the North Carolina Auto Racing Hall of Fame. And then we shot our first full-length show here in the studio, and it was shot as basically a second pilot, pretty much, because it was full-length and it was in the studio. And we did it in the format and with the type of sort of content that, you know, a show on there would have, that we would do for them would have. And really we did it for their critique. And what was interesting was that the critique that we got back was everything we thought we would get critiqued for, because it was all aesthetic. It was basically, you know, put something on the walls or repaint them, you know, ditch the handheld mics, you know, get mic stands. I mean, these are all things that we already knew we needed to do. We just hadn't, because we, you know, we were just in here. We just got the furniture like the day before I think we put it together the day before we shot that second pilot. So it's been an interesting journey because, you know, we knew that there were things they were going to want us to, you know, to do, and nothing that we hadn't already planned on. The funniest one was when the content developer told me to polish the dome, I think was the phrase that he used. And I had no idea. I repeated it back to him, you know, like, polish the dome. What? And he said, yes, polish the dome. And I said, I don't know what that means. You got to explain that to me. He said, it's a bald man's problem. And I, then I knew what he was talking about. Towel off, basically, before you turn on the camera. So, like, you, I guess, you know, someone who with as trained of an eye as he has, you know, could see a little bit of, like, sweat on the forehead or whatever. So he said, it's just, it's natural, just towel off. Well, so there you go. So, you know, I don't think I'll be hiring a makeup artist anytime soon to you know, do the sort of skin tone or whatever. that was pretty funny. But it's just been interesting because, again, these guys are top-notch. I mean, to have mentors like Brian and Ray to help us improve the quality and to be able to, I know that my producer is talented enough and everything that we did that we could control, he loved. There were just things that, you know, we just hadn't gotten that far, kind of. And it was like, okay, so the main thing was, you know, we sent it to him. We did it because we wanted to see if they were going to approve of the type of show and how we wanted to do it, and they loved it. So that was good. So it's basically a talk show, typical, you know, Tom-style talk show. Sometimes we'll have topics. Sometimes we'll just have guests for the whole hour. But it's going to be a good show, and we're going to be able to do a lot with it. Now, the exciting part is that not only did we get the blessing to, not only did they want the Tom show, but they wanted, they have given us the green light to produce other content, package 30-minute or an hour content. Again, keeping in mind this is TV, so unlike when you're doing a podcast or something for social where, you know, there's no set schedule of, you know, this show airs at 8, this show airs at 8:30, that kind of thing. You're just throwing it out there to the internet. You can make it as long or short as you want. You don't have to watch a clock. You know, everything here, this is TV, so we have to do it right. But the idea of being able to put together documentaries, you know, or package shows that sort of get, that show a race, but don't actually show a lot of the actual race. They're kind of just, it's the behind the scenes sort of thing. And to be able to bring stories about some of the people and the tracks and the events and all of that, it just, the beauty of it is, I mean, we're limited a bit by staffing, which really is a limitation of funding. So now we've got to go out like all the other shows do and try to get the funding together to do more of this. And we're hoping to do some outside stuff for 24 and then do a have a whole schedule for 25 that we do and have it all. But it really unleashes my creative ability to dream up, and my producers as well, to be able to think about, you know, what would make a good story, what's out there. And of course, you know, you think about things like the Chili Bowl, like the classic, like, you know, some of the other short track sort of staple events that happen, you know, it just, and being able to bring stories to this audience, which probably has no idea what half of the cars are, right? But it's a technical audience. They're used to watching programming that focuses on cars being built and is really sort of detail-oriented. So now we get to, it's not just about, you know, let's put a 30-minute highlight reel from, you know, the classic together, but it's let's do something that really dives into what a supermodified is, because that likely will blow their minds, right? So there's a lot of stuff that that can be done here, and I have access to so many different kinds of racing and so many amazing stories. And it's just it's really something. It's just been, even just the initial conversations and being able to learn from them and really understand how, you know, you're producing for television instead of producing for social. It's a big, big, big difference in quality and, you know, in how it, what it needs. So that's the story of what's happening here in terms of the space that we're in. It's a nice way to work, a very creative atmosphere here. We're in a park where there's machine shops and, you know, race teams and auto restoration businesses and such. So it's really just, it's cool. And very thankful and humbled and excited to be in this space and looking forward to seeing what we can do with this. You know, I bust my butt for everything, and it, you know, if someone's going to give me an opportunity like this, I'm going to do my best to make them happy. And that's the way I look at it, even though we're, you know, we're not working directly for PowerTube TV. I feel like that's how I'm looking at it, is, you know, this is the level we've got to hit because we want to please them. We want them to air the shows, and we want, you know, we want the people who are on the shows or the subjects of the shows, we want to do that justice. So it's given me a whole other level of creative work to do, just trying to put together the marketing end of it and all that, and trying to research and learn about how all that's done, because it's everything's different. When you're marketing TV, it's a different thing than when you're marketing social or YouTube. And yet social and all of that is part of this, because that's still part of who we are. We have the hub, our own hub, where we'll put the audio from all of these shows that we produce, but the video will be available. The full-length video shows will be available exclusively on PowerTube TV, at least for the foreseeable future. Their audience is well over a million worldwide, U.S., Canada, Australia, etc. And it's a great opportunity for, again, to bring some content to it that that is nothing like what they have. They added a Cars and Coffee show, which I think is wicked cool. And again, very simple. Concept simple. They've added WFO. If you've never heard or watched WFO, it stands for what you think it would, wide blanking open, right? And WFO Joe was doing a podcast, I think, before podcasting was even podcasting. He's been around forever. And so his show talks about mostly drag racing now. But there's some NASCAR and other stuff mixed in, but he's great. Does a great job. I've never met him, but I've listened to his stuff, and, we'll of course start watching it now on PowerTube, but, it's good stuff. So they've added a few of those types of shows that are new, and our timeline hopefully is April. That's what we're shooting for. We've got to get the studio finished up and get some more equipment and such to, but we're hoping for as close to the beginning of April as possible. It's really, again, there's we're working on funding to be able to do some of this, but once it's done, it's done. And we're excited. We're just really, really excited. It's really an opportunity. You know, it's not so much, I mean, I just do what I do and I enjoy it and I'm blessed that my passion can be my profession, but I just want to bring some of these stories to as many people as possible, right? So Super Modifieds are obviously a part of that because I love them. And the open wheel, open cockpit stuff, in this light, will just get bunches, I would have to think, because people won't know what in the wide world of sports it is. So, you know, they want to know everything about it, right? And again, it's an audience that's very sort of technically focused, since a lot of these shows are, you know, that way. And so not so much maybe the engineering part, but the aesthetic part and, you know, all of that. I think how the wings work, you know, those sorts of things. I just think it'll be totally fascinating to them to see something different. And so that's going to be great. So we're excited about all that. So there's that. And I want to talk about a couple of other quick things too that I've heard about that are happening. First of all, I think we can safely put to bed the NESS New England show, since it is Friday of the weekend they were supposed to come here, and they're not coming. I wouldn't have imagined. It just didn't make sense to me, quite honestly, that a series that, you know, really didn't want to travel outside of New England would have come all the way to Hickory, North Carolina. And I don't think, honestly, I don't think the time is right. There's only about 10 cars. Now, I've heard that there may be a few more this year, which would be great. I hope that series grows to be 20 or 25 cars a race. We need more supers on the track, right? It doesn't matter what series they're running. So that would be great. It just felt like it would have been like, wow, there's only 8, you know, and there was no, I figured it wasn't going to happen because there was just no buzz. There was no pre-promotion. Nobody was confirming it was happening. So, that won't be a thing, but you know, maybe next year, maybe there'll be 15 cars in the series and maybe, you know, they'll get them all next year. And, in the meantime, of course, at the end of November, MSS comes down here to be part of the North-South shootout, at Caraway Speedway. And I can tell you, there's already people down here that I talk to that are in other forms of the sport that are just over the moon about going to that show now that the Supers are there, who wouldn't have gone otherwise. So I already know that the Supers are going to bring people to that race who would not have shown up and bought a ticket if they weren't there, which is, that's great. So I'm hoping that we get 20 plus Supers. That really needs to be a thing. And I'm encouraging strongly all super modified teams, Oswego, New England, whoever, okay, Midwest, ISMA, Canada, you need to support this show, because I can tell you the potential for this show to get even bigger is definitely there, dollars-wise and otherwise. It's there. This, when ISMA pulled that trigger, I don't think even ISMA realizes, or, you know, Danny and Laura, I don't think ISMA MSS realizes fully what the ceiling is here for this. There are a lot of people talking about it. And, you know, I obviously am going to help that. So I'm going to do everything I can to make sure everybody knows and everybody goes, because this show needs to become a staple supermodified marquee event every freaking year. You know, come into NASCAR country and show them what a real race car is like. That's really what needs to happen here. So I'm excited to see that. And then the other thing that I heard, which I find to be very interesting, is that the SMAC tour for the 350s is planning, I'm going to call it a rumor because nobody has actually confirmed to me personally that it is happening. But it seems to be that it's happening. 10,000 to win race somewhere. And it's got to be either Evans Mills, Lancaster, or Spencer, because I think those are the only three tracks in New York that SMAC's running. So 10,000 to win for a 350 is a lot of money. It's a lot of money. Almost too much, in my opinion. I'd like to see it 5,000 to win, take the other five, put it in the back. Give more teams, and I think this just needs, I'm going to keep campaigning for this, because this is how we're going to really build short track racing specifically. If we're going to build it, it's going to be by making it as inexpensive as possible for somebody to take their car, load it on the trailer, and go to the racetrack. You know, if you can get tires, fuel, and even part of your travel paid for, that makes it a whole lot easier. You know, if you could look at it like, okay, I'm going to get enough money to start so I can pay all the pit passes, the tires, the fuel, you know, and food. So basically to be at the racetrack, you know, isn't costing us anything, then it makes it a little easier to swallow, especially if you're traveling any distance, swallow the cost of gas and, you know, hotel or whatever, right? And adjust the maintenance of the car. I've been saying, and I'm not alone, Dale Jr. says it, and Dale Jr.'s done it. You know, you put more money at the back of the purse, it makes it easier for everybody. You put big money to win, that's really, to me, that's a, how do I put this nicely? That's an ego trip for the promoter, and only one person gets the benefit. And, you know, a lot of times, depending on the type of racing that it is, all the big money teams show up, and then the local, the smaller funded teams have no chance to win at that point, so they don't. I see that in karting all the time. There are dirt kart shows paying, you know, $20,000-$50,000 to win. They're less now, thank God, because it's just a bad idea. You know, I've never been in favor of that sort of a thing because it only benefits one team in the end. We need more money at the back of the purse to make it easier and less expensive to race. That benefits everyone, right? So, but I just think it's interesting that SMAC is doing that. I don't know. You know, I don't know a lot of the detail, and I don't even know where or when it is, if they've even, but that's the rumor is that there's going to be a 10,000 to win smack race. So guess we'll see. I, you know, the 350 thing for me is a bit of an enigma because, you know, I have no problem with, you know, the principle of having a group of cars that wants to do their own thing. The principle of that's okay. I mean, it's free country. The downfall is when you only have a small amount and you're splitting the field by rule or lack of rule, depending on the situation, right? It's hard to, you know, then it's like, well, can we not at least have some shows where we all get together so everybody can see a full field instead of 15? You know, that's really the thing. And the TQ midgets were a great example of how to take four or five different groups whose only commonality is they're all TQs really, and bring them together, which they did in Auburndale here last month. And it worked out for the betterment of everybody because, there were 20 of them there. And next year they're going to get an extra day and we're shooting for 40. And that seems reasonable from what I'm hearing from from those who raced them. Everybody had a great time. And these were a mix of cars, some of which run for clubs that run wings. Some of them don't. Some of them run bigger wings than the other ones that run wings. You know, everybody and motors, I think the motors are pretty much the same, but, you know, everybody had a certain weight they had to be. They used weight to kind of even everybody out. Everybody had fun. Nobody complained. It was great. And I think that's an example of where I think we should get to with the 350s. How do we make this so everybody's, you know, everybody's, and it's not even about, you do want it to be close enough where, you know, all of the guys can compete for a win. But it's just, how do we get everybody excited about going and supporting 350s wherever they are, just like what's starting to happen with the big blocks now that we took ISMA, MSS, and Oswego and just, you know, made a common schedule so that everybody has their share and everybody can support everything. It's definitely helped the car count. So that's for the 350s. I just want to see it get to a point, and I don't want to see it get more and more expensive. You know, the rules have to be held in check, because that the whole reason that class is as big as it is, even in New England, is because it was so much less expensive than the big block supers, right? So, you know, people who are interested in supers could afford to race them. And it's still basically a super modified. It's the same thing, same car. And I really want to see Oswego's field grow faster. And I'm really not sure why it hasn't. I'd love for somebody to be able to explain to me why it hasn't. Because I would have thought by now we'd be approaching 20 cars a week, and I don't think we're at that point unless we've had a big winter with them. And they put on great racing. So I don't know why it hasn't grown faster. If anybody can tell me, I would welcome that that knowledge and that understanding. If it's, you know, I can't imagine its cost per se. I mean, granted, they're still more expensive than a four cylinder, but obviously, you know, you're just, there's only so much, but they're way less expensive than a big block. It would seem like this would be a price point where everybody could play, and we've seen drivers come in and go out and come in and go out. So I would love to understand why is this field not getting really big really quick? What's slowing the growth? And I know Smack Tour is part of that, because there are people who live a short distance from Oswego. I mean, shoot, but they're running Smack. And as far as I know, I think the biggest difference is the motor. So, you know, and I've heard both sides of that. You know, and each side has its own compelling argument for what they're doing. But I think that the big thing is we have to mind the fort when it comes to both cost. And I think drivers from both sides, the crates and the builds or whatever, should be willing to come together and compete against each other and support until the class grows to the point where you got 20 plus on each side, then you can, you know, you can, but that, cause that's what happened to the big blocks. And that's why it's still, you have to run a classic to get 30 cars at Oswego. And even then, what we have 31 last year. I mean, that, you know, back in the 70s, the track folks were complaining when they only had 30 cars. That was a bad night, you know. And I say that because I know it. It's in writing. I've read it in programs where it's the Ivor or the editorial editor or whatever, you know, we only had 35 cars. Like, holy cow. When was the last time we had 35 supers, big block supers, the pits at Oswego at the same time? So the big block, that the problem's not solved. John Nicotra's money series helped it, and saved it, probably. In all reality, it probably saved big block super modified racing, at least at Oswego, but we're still only getting 50 to 20, which, you know, again, I'm not poo-pooing car count or you know, making it just about car count, but we're not getting a lot of new blood. We've got Junior Ferrelli out of Canada who's bought Otto Siderley's car. I think he's going to run six times, so he's not full-time. That's kind of the thing is you really, you know, how do we get new full-time blood into the big blocks? And I think the first thing you do is you make your small blocks stronger. Really work hard to build up the small blocks, get more people into a super. And then let them, hopefully the big block is cost effective somewhat, because you know, I will never agree with anybody who says you can't cut costs or they don't want to cut costs. If you can't afford to race it, too bad. If you're going to grow the division for the long term, you cannot have that attitude. That is the wrong attitude. You can't be a snob. You can't say, well, I got money. You don't. Too bad. Go race what you can afford. You can't. That's not the attitude. You have to always be conscious of cost. So when it comes to tires, motors, whatever, and, you know, all of it. And so having bigger purses is one way to, but only if the purse makes it easier for people to race. You know, if it's a big money race to win, that doesn't solve anything. It's start money that matters. So I hope, and there's so much, right now I think 2024 has the opportunity to be the biggest year that super modified racing as a whole has had in a long time. If you look at the West Coast and the momentum that's going on out there, you look at what's happening at Oswego and ISMA MSS, and, you know, I don't really know what the showdown deal is going to be like, Davey Hamilton's deal at this point, because it seems like supers aren't even being talked about. I don't really know where all that's going. It feels to me a little like he's concentrating on his other divisions and really isn't, at least as of yet, hasn't chosen to make much of the supers, and he moved it four and a half hours farther west from Vegas to Irwindale Speedway in California. So now you have, you know, it's even a longer drive for the East Coast cars. So I think that's pretty much going to be a West Coast only thing, which is still fine, because again, if that gets the attention, the pay-per-view, all that, and especially if there's one or two even East Coast cars with, you know, folks who have the money and the ability to do it that can tow out there and take part, that's fine. But so far, I'm not hearing a lot of momentum on the supers like I have on the other two divisions. So I'm not sure where that's going, but that's why I'm saying I think this North Carolina race is critical. Absolutely critical. That we have to build this up. I think that's the perfect addition. And to be quite honest with you, I think it ought to be a points race next year. I don't know why they did it as non-point show. I think it should be a point race. This should be your championship race, in my opinion. And the reason I say that is because, again, if you think about it from the big picture, it's great that Evans Mills has the classic and their classic, and that, I think that's, is that still the, I think it is still the championship race. This should be the championship race. It gives more incentive for drivers to come. And also, it makes the race itself more prestigious. And because the likelihood of more drivers coming gets increased, it also makes it more marketable. So this could be a big, you know, kind of a, I say big money, but certainly, you know, a good, strong, there's room for this purse to grow. And there's plenty of available resource here. And it's unique. This could be a once a year super modified race in North Carolina, and I could see the potential for this to be one of the biggest super modified that it could rival the Oswego Classic. So, you know, the market's here, the fan base is here. New York, for those who don't know, is the number one transplant state to North Carolina. I didn't know that till maybe a month ago. I can't remember where I read an article that talked about that. And that's as of 23, I guess it would have been. New York was number one overall. And I don't think it was just for 23. I think it was, you know, they were saying that some sort of total, how they got to that, I don't know. But New York was number one. And it's not all, I know it's a banking, I know Charlotte's banking and New York City's banking, and you get a lot of back and forth there. But, you know, awful lot of people come down here for racing. And so I think this race should be treated as a race that could be become eventually a rival. I don't want to use that word rival, but become, you know, a classic size event. The opportunity's there. So it just all depends what ISMA and MSS do with it and how many drivers choose to support it. If it gets a strong turnout of 20-plus cars this year, I like the chances for the dollars that that race could pay for next year. I like the chances of those dollars increasing significantly. But it's going to depend on how many cars show up. If we only get 13 or 14, it's not going to look like much of a big show. It's going to be a companion show. It needs to be big enough so that the super modifieds come in and basically steal the show. So the supers and the modifieds become the two biggest classes. And then, obviously, hopefully it's a good race and lots passing and everybody's excited and, you know, crowd goes wild and that sort of thing. So it's going to be real interesting to see where this goes. All right. I am way long for this segment, but hope that you enjoyed the information and thank all of you for listening to the show and supporting the show. And look forward. We've already got the structure for next week's show lined out. So know who the guest is going to be. We're not going to tease it. We've got at least one guest lined up. We may have two. So look forward to next week and to the season ahead here on The Groove now that we're in our new space and starting to get settled here, and more content to come. I'm sure we'll have some sort of, you know, at some point we will start doing some video content with Super Modified that's Super Modify related. Probably won't be the actual show, but, you know, We'll do what we can and do as much as we can, because obviously it's my first love still. So with all that being said, thanks for listening, everybody. Appreciate each and all of you and your support. And again, prayers and well wishes for a speedy recovery to Gary Albritton, and the address that you can send a card or a note to will be in the post for this show. So just look at what I type in the box and you'll see that information. So if you'd like to drop Gary a card or a note, you know, you can do that. So again, thanks everyone. Have a great weekend and we'll talk to you next time on Inside Groove. Until then, I'm Tom Baker. Thanks for listening. So long.
You've been listening to Inside Groove, powered by IPC Indy, creating performance parts and solutions for the automotive, aerospace, and communications industries. Find them on the web at www.ipcindy.com. The opinions expressed by our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, affiliates, or marketing partners. No part of this show may be reproduced in any manner without the expressed written consent of Race Chaser Media. Thank you for listening.